He's the 29th?
Yeah.
Yes, it's November the 29th, 19... January. January the 29th, 1979, and an interview with Lieutenant General Lane by Dr. Reg Roy.
Yeah, I thought I would have time to listen to the last tape on the FLQ and, you know, have a nice lineup of questions here, but last week was, as usual, out of this world, and I haven't. Of course, what strikes me is not only the crisis itself and the role played by the Army, but your position as an airman, as deputy in charge of the mobile command. But the more I thought of it, the more I realized, and one must realize, that you have charge of a command, and you're not operational. In other words, you're not an airman leading a patrol of soldiers down the street or anything of that nature. No. And so I think many of the questions that I had would be, in a sense, superfluous. You yourself, your own house presumably was guarded.
Yes. But done in conjunction with the guarding of a consulate that was behind the house behind us.
Yeah.
So the actual guards were physically located in the entrance and around the property of the consulate, because that was the primary concern. But at the same time, they kept coming over to the house and would check and walk around my property about once an hour or something like that, do a patrol. So their presence was known.
What about internal arrangements, Reg? Were there any extra locks in the door or anything of that nature?
No, nothing more than just the security of the headquarters was tightened up a bit, as was the security of the base. It's interesting that Laporte, when he was found in a vehicle, in the trunk of a vehicle that was not very, very far away from St. Hubert. As a matter of fact, it was quite close to St. Hubert. And but not, of course, anywhere near the military installation as such. No, the security was a simple matter of tightening up with additional guards around. Goodness gracious, we had enough troops around that right on the base that we were patrolling all the damn time that, to take care of any real security requirements.
Wasn't it at this time also, or was it a bit later, that a bomb went off outside NDHQ building in Ottawa?
That's right, it did. Very true. It was, and that happened, as I recall, it wasn't during working hours, and so no one was hurt, but it was a fairly healthy explosive.
It
knocked out a lot of windows and so forth,
but
didn't do any real structural damage.
Yeah.
I don't know who was behind it. We, as I think I have already said, we were never sure who the hell was doing what to whom.
Yeah.
We were trying to piece all these things together, and then and all those little billy-doos that kept popping up or being handed over to radio stations or sent to newspapers or phoned in were supposedly coming from different cells of the FLQ, making it appear as if it was a properly orchestrated and coordinated operation.
Yeah.
Again, it wasn't until it was all over that we really, really established the fact that they were disconnected, that they almost didn't know each other, much less be coordinating their efforts. People who had some sort of a chip on their shoulder for whatever reason were finding it possible to take action and get it out of their system and blame it on the FLQ, I think. I know. But I don't think we'll ever know the full extent of that unless many of those who were involved at some time sit down and write a little confession. I was the one who did that at that time because I felt so-and-so and I believed so-and-so. As opposed to the two hardcore cells, the ones that really caused all our trouble, the one that held, the one that ultimately killed Laporte, and of course the one that held the cross in that house in North Montreal for all that long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Very small cells, but boy, very vocal.
Yeah.
Very vocal.
Yeah.
But, and then there were all kinds of people who were undoubtedly fellow travelers who felt the same way and would and did take action. They were either making... of course, once the War Measures Act was declared, things like parades, gatherings in the parks and at the university and so forth, those were all taboo, and fortunately, the majority of the people realized that they were taboo, and there was no confrontation. The police never did have to come out in their large quantities, in their large numbers, to handle a mob, or a riot situation, or a major demonstration. They were ready for it. As a matter of fact, the Montreal police and were undoubtedly the best organized, certainly in North America at that time, for handling a demonstration. And their technique, I don't think I described their technique.
No, but
one of the things that they would do is, there was one of the major parks in sort of central Montreal was a great gathering place for demonstrations. And they'd get anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 people at these things, and they'd be harangued by various speakers with PA systems, and then there would be a great march on City Hall or whatever it would be. Well, most of them never really got off the ground. Once the haranguing had finished, a lot of the demonstrators just quietly peeled off and went home and said, "Oh, to hell with that! I don't want any part of that." But there never was a major confrontation, a major demonstration that really required the police. But had there been, the tactics Montreal police were actually quite simple, but very effective. They would let the demonstration come down, or they would try to get the demonstration to come down as many streets as possible from the park, preferably not just down one. Let's for the sake of argument say they were going to the City Hall. They would try and get them to come down two or three streets. But if they all came down one, the police would then wait at the first intersection, and they would try and pick off the lead, and they would divert the lead, say, to the left or to the right. And after they'd peeled off about 100, they would then just quietly let the rest of the demonstrators continue on down that main thoroughfare as if they were still heading. And then there would be another group waiting for them at the next block, and then they would peel off another 100, or particularly the leaders, as they were the people up front, and they wanted to get them off so that they wouldn't know quite what was going on. And there would be not necessarily a heavy scuffle, but there would have been a little bit of a scuffle while they quietly peeled these people off. And the head of the demonstration would be a couple of blocks down before they suddenly realized, where the hell did our leaders go? They're no longer with us. But the idea was to constantly do this, quietly breaking up the lead of the demonstration, until by the time they'd gone down 10 or 12 blocks, a lot of them had been dispersed. And then, of course, down these side streets, were the police, who would then quietly prod them along and say, "Well, you better just keep going in that general direction." And if they did give them a hard time, they'd be picked up and thrown into a paddy wagon and then wheeled off to a police station and then released about 2 or 3 hours later. But very effectively breaking up the whole thrust of the demonstration. The other thing they were ready for, of course, was not so much a movement as having to break up a demonstration where it was necessary for whatever reason. Perhaps they were beginning to do damage or something like that. Then they had their stormtroops who could move in with shields and gas masks and their billy sticks and could do a pretty effective job. Mm-hmm. But again, they never had to. They were ready, though. My goodness, they were ready. We had the chief of police come out and tune mobile and give us a full-blown briefing, so that we at Mobile would understand how the police would handle a major demonstration. So that we would then, we at headquarters would know what the hell it was all about. Not just the battalion commanders and so forth, but right at the senior staff. And that was where we were very thoroughly briefed on the methods they would use. And we were impressed. We really were.
It's a classic tactic, quite frankly. Yeah. What about the battalions themselves, were they practicing?
No. The battalions had, as a part of their normal training prior to this, had, of course, trained in handling a public demonstration of one kind or another, but always behind the front of the civil authority. But they had similar tactics of using shields and that sort of thing to help break up. But to get the military involved with an actual confrontation with the public is that I don't give a damn whether they're armed or not armed is not a good thing.
Yeah.
They, to all intents and purposes, if you like, become strike breakers, and that's a dreadful thing to have the services tarred with, a terrible thing. But, of course, they did just in case the police were unable to handle the situation before it got down to a shooting situation. Thank goodness we never did. Never did have a shooting situation. Of course, everybody, both sides lose when that starts.
As
they're finding out in Iran right now,
the
military trying to break up demonstrations, and they've reached the point where they have to shoot into the mobs, and they're killing people. That just means that the large percentage of the public now look on the military as being very anti, and the whole thing is going to come apart at the seams.
It's
a bad situation.
I know. Did you people have rubber bullets at this time?
No. We had, as I recall, I should make a point here, right throughout this whole series of talks, this has all been right off the top of my head, memory-wise. And some of the timing may be out as a result of trying to recall the sequence of events. No, I don't recall anything in the way of rubber boots. As a matter of fact, you remember I said that one of the things the lads were briefed on before they went out, that they must not have a bullet up the spout. Because they were live, that was live ammunition they were being issued with. Not rubber bullets, live ammunition. And therefore, we didn't want somebody falling or tripping and accidentally firing his weapon. We wanted nothing up the spout. No, we didn't have rubber bullets. So they were live issue ammunition.
Was there, of course, this FLQ crisis went on for some time. And I'm just wondering if, either during the crisis or as a result of the crisis, there was a reorientation in the training of the infantry to some degree.
Not really. Because we had... I think that we had fairly well thought the thing through. We, certainly Mobile Command, the Army had, in those years when they were practicing such things as civil defense and aid to the civil power. I think they had, in their various exercises, tried to anticipate or write every possible scenario, so they were ready for it. This is what was put into practice and done extremely well during the FLQ crisis. When it was over, there were reports written, naturally, on the whole operation. But I don't recall anything that one might describe as being a major change in the concept of handling that kind of situation. What had happened was that it had more or less verified the thinking that had gone on prior to the FLQ crisis. And a very fundamental thing that had been established well before was that the military, under those conditions, were nothing more than an extension of civil authority. But it was civil authority that had to retain control. And the only situation, and I don't think we had ever, no one, and I still don't think we would reach the situation in Canada, not under our present system of government and control, where we would have to declare martial law. And by declaring martial law, be ready, or hand over total authority to the military, as opposed to the civil authority. And there was that never even once entered any conversation anywhere. There was, because it was such a big city, and they had a lot of resources in Montreal. They were brought in from all over Quebec, just the provincial police alone. Is a fairly big force in Quebec. And you throw in the Montreal police and all the police forces of the immediate environs of Montreal, which was where, if there was going to be a big issue, it was likely to be in Montreal. You put those all together and you've got an enormous force. You would need, and well-armed, well-trained, and you would need an extremely large revolutionary force, armed, before you would go beyond the point where that civil authority or civil police would not be able to cope and where it would be necessary to bring in the military. That is military in a confrontation position, not as we were brought in, which was to help the police in doing a little bit of guard duty, watching, looking after those places where the police felt that they might be subject to some kind of sabotage, so that they could then devote most of their time, which is what they did, in moving in on those civilians who were suspect, rounding them up, doing searches, wide searches while they were looking for Cross, taking whole areas of Montreal and almost districts and descending in hundreds and hundreds and quickly wading through, searching every house, looking for Cross. Mind you, Montreal's a big city. They never did get all over Montreal, naturally.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of rumors. There was a lot of... The police reacted to anything which seemed to make sense. A phony phone call. Someone would write in an anonymous letter and saying, if you're looking for so-and-so, go to so-and-so. The kooky type of thing. And, of course, if it made any sense, then the police would move. And they'd spend an awful lot of effort chasing threads and leads, which had been presented by people who were just kooky and being mischievous in a very tough situation.
Yeah.
As opposed to the proper, as opposed to the think tank and the Joint Operations Center in downtown Montreal actually bringing together all the intelligence and trying to figure out in what likely area would someone then move in.
Yeah.
But it was a long time before they found Cross.
Well, speaking of this, wasn't there an incident, or am I wrong, where as time goes on and they don't find Cross, a spiritualist is brought in?
Oh, yes, there... I don't remember the exact case, but I should say it rings a bell. But there were many incidents of that nature where the people came forward and said, "This is where that sort of thing."
Yeah.
As we now have, when it happened very recently with that aircraft that crashed in the central BC, and a couple of these. People came forward and said, now if you go and look on the glacier in the southeast corner of that particular glacier, you'll find them.
I had a vision.
That's right. Yeah. It's Oculus, whatever they call themselves.
Yeah.
And, oh boy.
Yeah, that's another story in itself. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's take you away from Quebec. When did you hear word that you're about to be moved?
Well, it would be in the summer of 72, or spring. It would be the spring of 72 when the I had received word that I was going to be appointed as the deputy commander of NORAD, and I was asked if I would accept the position, as a matter of fact, and I said, sure, by all means. Again, I had rather thought that maybe they might throw me into NDHQ, having now had another command experience, and that mobile command was my third command position in a row, after air transport and then the air division and then mobile. But I said, no, by all means, because this was going to be my last tour. I knew a fair amount about NORAD, having been in plans at the time when the whole thing was put together, and having kept a fairly close tab on what was going on. And it was a very, very nice position. There's no question about that. So, I accepted, and then in the summer we went down.
Now, this would mean a promotion for you.
Oh, yes, it also meant a promotion. Yes, yes, it did mean a promotion.
You'd be how old at this time?
I was 52 then. 52.
Right.
And then, of course, I was promoted immediately. I left Mobile Command to take over the job.
Mm-hmm.
We went down with the family and had a terrible time finding accommodation. My predecessor had a house that I suppose would have been all right for perhaps a couple, but it was in terribly run down. Even believe it or not, the roof was actually leaking. It was really in bad shape, and the drapes were in shocking condition. The whole house needed several thousands of dollars repairs.
Was this a government house?
No, this was a rental. No, there was nothing provided. You had to go find accommodation. You had to go and find a house to rent. And it was at a time when Colorado Springs was expanding at a rapid rate, and therefore accommodation was very, very hard to come by. And we, in sheer desperation, had to take a house that wasn't what we felt we should have had because of the position. And what was worse, we had to accept it before it was even finished. It was under construction. So we had to live in an apartment for over a month while this house was being finished, and still moved in to the place when the carpenters were still doing finishing touches around the place and so forth, and carpets were being laid, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Again, a rented house.
A rented house. And the deal was that because of the size of the house, it was beyond the individual capacity, and it required Treasury Board assistance to pay for it. In other words, a subsidized type of rent. Treasury Board were very reluctant to approve expenditures of this nature, and so we had to, when we were looking for a place, we knew we were operating under something of a handicap in terms of, well, what's the rent going to be? Because we knew damn well that Treasury would balk if they had felt they were going to have to pay too much. And it was narky. I felt it was bad because here we'd been in NORAD all those many years since, about 58, I suppose, 59. Mm-hmm. And damn it, we'd had an awful lot of deputy things go through the place. And at no time had the government really thought of buying a place or taking a long-term lease on a proper home. Because it is a very much of a representation type of job. You have a lot of visitors arrive at NORAD from all over the world, and some of the deputies think is required to do some of the entertaining of these people when they come in to help share the load.
When you say for our secretary, when you say sink, that's
C. Oh, the commander in chief. The commander in chief.
C-I-N-C,
yeah. Commander-in-Chief of NORAD.
Yeah.
When the commander-in-chief, between the deputy commander and the commander, there was a certain amount of, it was required that the entertaining be shared, although the Americans carried by far the large load of this and made, the commander himself had a pot of money for entertaining purposes. I shouldn't say entertaining. It's really the wrong word. It's really representation, which results in entertaining of high-priced visitors.
Yeah.
That was fairly staggering. As always, the Americans didn't. But it was nevertheless not enough to cover everything, and it was expected that the deputy or the Canadian would carry his share, because after all, it was a joint command, and the financing of the. Now, the whole operation, theoretically, was a shared one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, representation, and of course, particularly if Canadians came down. There was no doubt about who was going to do the entertaining if Canadians turned up. Well, it meant as the commander-in-chief did, he had a fabulous place. Funnily enough, the Americans, and it's amazing the way things work out, when NORAD was set up, the first thing we got there was looking for a house. And the Chamber of Commerce and several businessmen in Colorado Springs said, you know, this is going to be important. This is going to be important to Colorado Springs. Therefore, what can we do to help? And, of course, the first general said, well, hell, the first thing you do is find me a decent house. Well, they interpreted that, I think, perhaps a little differently to what he meant. And what they did was, including some bankers and so forth, they went out and bought what can only be described as a rather palatial home, sort of like 12 bedrooms with 12 bathrooms and that kind of thing, and about 2 or 3 acres of grounds, including a swimming pool and tennis courts and so forth. They bought it and then rented it to the general for his rent allowance that was a part of his pay. And that went on for years and years and years and years, and it was furnished the whole nine yards wide. The basic furniture was all the general had to do was bring in and add to his own personal belongings.
Yeah.
And, for example, I suppose 10 of the 12 bedrooms were very, very nicely furnished indeed. And but it was a hell of a nice home. But that was done by businessmen. Mm-hmm. I don't know what I suppose the federal government would have probably provided a home if they hadn't done it initially.
Yeah.
But not for Canada. The Canadians jumped around several places. And it is a little galling because when I look back on it, because just recently, I'm damned if the government did not take out a long-term lease on a very, very nice home up in the Broadmoor, which is now the designated home for the deputy commander-in-chief and personal belongings.
Yeah.
And, for example, I suppose 10 of the 12 bedrooms were very, very nicely furnished indeed. And but it was a hell of a nice home. But that was done by businessmen. I don't know I suppose the federal government would have probably provided a home if they hadn't done it initially.
Yeah.
But not for Canada. The Canadians jumped around several places. And it is a little galling because when I look back on it, because just recently, I'm damned if the government did not take out a long-term lease on a very, very nice home up in the Broadmoor, which is now the designated home for the deputy commander-in-chief. And Treasury Board have come forward with all the money in the world to make that possible, which is the way it should have been right from the word go. Mm-hmm. And now the deputy commander is in, as I say, a very nice house that's really designed for entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
And he can have people stay, and he can have the dinner parties and the cocktail parties, which are all part of representation, and do it nicely, with a great view. He's got a house with a fantastic view up on the side of the mountain. In other words, a damn nice setup, and I only regret that the government hadn't made that decision a long, long, long time ago, because it would have saved a lot of heartburn for several of the previous deputy commanders.
Who did you replace, by the way? Did you replace...
Rhino. Ed Rhino.
R-E-Y-N-O.
Oh, I see. And he retired. He was retiring. Most of the people who go to that job, most.
Yeah.
It really is their last tour, because after all, it is a 3-star position, and it is normally given to someone who is on their last tour. In this the particular deputy sink, though, Kenny Lewis is much younger, and this normally would not be his last tour, and I don't think it will be his last tour. And the only reason why I'm hesitating is I don't know quite what he'll do afterwards, whether he could become the chief.
Mm-hmm.
If he doesn't become the chief, I'm really, maybe he could go over to Europe. I don't know quite where they would fit him in if he doesn't become chief. It becomes mm-hmm. a little tricky that way.
Mm-hmm.
But he's young enough that this is not his last tour, as it was for most people. After we found a house, of course, in the meantime, I had started to work. And like any new job, it was absolutely essential to spend most of the time being briefed. And I must have gone through some 3 weeks to a month of solid briefings, many of which were repeated, because there were a lot of operational procedures and drills that had to be absolutely buttoned up, and you just couldn't grasp them all in one go around. And then, after all of that time spent on being briefed, and that included intelligence being brought up to speed, and in an intelligence field that was completely new in the sense of being amazed at just how much intelligence the Americans did have. Even though I at one time had been chief of plans and intelligence, we had worked very closely together.
Mm-hmm.
It was enough time and water had gone under the bridge that intelligence methods and so forth had improved to the point where the amount of information was truly quite staggering.
Mm-hmm.
And then the operational procedures. Because the ops room in NORAD headquarters is almost overwhelming. There's so much going on, and not in a quiet period, even though there's a lot going on, but that when you see it in the middle of an exercise, or when an exercise hits, or an alert hits, all of a sudden there's just so much going on that if you aren't absolutely okay with what every little sign and indicator that's being flashed around the bloody place means, and all popping out of computers, very quickly you lose track, you lose the thread, and you're lost. Well, you get behind that power curve, and you're dead. Take time.
This is the room that looks like Christchurch Cathedral, with the screen at the back, and the banks of computers and telephones and TVs. And
that's right. And all the whole nine yards. The screen is an interesting one. It cost them, I think it was $1.5 million to develop that screen. And what happened was that the idea was that the screen was nothing more really than a projection, an image projection from a photograph. What had to happen, and this is where the money went, information would be put up on a display and would be photographed. And that photograph had to be developed and then projected onto the screen, and it took 7 seconds to actually go through that process of actually taking a photograph, developing it, and then projecting it onto a screen.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the main big screen. Now, there were a lot of other little information slots which were fed by computers specifically, and those were all over the place, and they would change as the computer popped up the information. Mm-hmm. But those were more of a digital or a symbolic thing rather than the big screen, which was a map, basically a map of North America.
Mm-hmm.
And then on that map, they could project. The main projection with North America, they could project the world too, sort of like another map, if you will. Mm-hmm. But the one that was normally up on the screen was North America. But then they could superimpose on that any unknowns which would appear in the system, in the detection system, that is an air-breathing type airplane, and its location and its movement, which way it was going, and all the pertinent information on it. And they could also project on it any incoming missiles, so that you'd have an idea of what the track was,
mm-hmm.
and time of impact, estimated time of impact for those missiles. But that information was projected on this big screen with that roughly 7 seconds. It wasn't exactly real time.
Mm-hmm.
There was just that slight delay built in. But for purposes of what we needed, it was, to all intents and purposes, real time. The ops room procedures were very important, and after all the briefings, began to sit in on exercises. And they do have an extremely good exercise organization in NORAD headquarters. Just a fantastic group. Not large, but brilliant people who can put together scenarios that are just wild. And they, of course, because it is nearly all computerized, when they write the scenario, it has to be put on tapes. And there's a very large contract with the System Development Corporation in Santa Monica. I don't know what the value of the contract is today, but while I was there, it was about $3.5 million a year. Given to SDC, who did nothing but take the scenarios, the written scenarios, and then would put them on tapes,
mm-hmm.
for the computers, which were could be taken off real time and used to run these tapes for exercise purposes. And some of the exercises would last up to 3 days. So you'd need a lot of tapes for that kind of thing. Other exercises would last a day, 24 hours. But even so, you need a lot of tapes. And so that was why there was a fair amount of money spent in developing these tapes.
Yeah.
A lot of the tapes could be used. A lot of the information that was on tapes, it wasn't necessarily a question of throwing everything away, because a lot of the information could be reused. But, but it still had to be all put together in time sequence, with each event occurring at the right time. And the other important thing is that these tapes could be sent out. Let's for the sake of argument, take a ballistic missile early warning site. Let's take the one up at Thule. it would play an important part in an exercise because it would be getting some picking up some missiles, incoming missiles. Well, the tapes would actually be flown to Thule and be there and put on their computer at Thule.
Oh, I see.
And the whole thing had to be done. The timing had to be right. In other words, now you get down to split second timing. If the exercise was to start at 0001, it was at 0001. Those tapes would all cut in, no matter where they were around the world.
Yeah,
they would immediately all cut in at exactly the same time because everything was a time sequence naturally, and then they would begin to feed through the communications net. So it was not only just a test of the computer; it was a test of all the communications too, to feed the information into NORAD headquarters, where it would all be assimilated and presented, and then the op staff and the commander would have to make their decisions on the information that they were getting.
What about the sub-district commanders? Would it be also appearing on their screens?
No, not entirely. Because you have to divide the ops aspect into really two sides. One is the missile threat, and the other was the air-breathing threat.
Hmm.
Now, the missile information was passed back out. It was relayed back out to the various regional commanders who were only air defense, not space defense, just pure air defense. It was relayed back out to them so they were aware of what was going on and they would display it in their ops rooms, but it would be done manually. It was not a real-time thing. There would be a time lapse in that. And if it was a panic, if there was, for whatever reason, there was a panic. Well, let me just take a wild one. An incoming missile, and it was obvious that the missile was targeted against one of the regional centers.
Yeah.
Then, of course, that would call for an immediate phone call, bingo, right through to the commander to tell him that there was a missile that was coming in. It was obviously heading for him, and it was going to hit in 20 minutes. That was it. He'd better do what he could intervening period besides saying, you know, our father kind of thing.
Start digging your footprint.
Yeah, whatever, yeah. So, but the information that when we got during an exercise to an incoming bomber raid, then the information which was being picked up by the radars, and this was now done actually, this was done by SAC, the U.S. Navy, using actual airplanes as the enemy bomber force. And they would come in different directions. And therefore, and so the radar would actually pick them up. Now, we could do live. That was what was called a live exercise.
Yeah.
And you could simulate it also by the use of tapes.
Yeah.
But the SAC were airborne all the damn time, and as were the U.S. Navy, and so we used to use them wherever we possibly could because it was better. Here's a real case of live rather than a tape.
By SAC, I mean
Strategic Air Command. Yeah. Now, the information that was picked up by the radars and transmitted to the regional centers was then retransmitted to NORAD headquarters, again by computer, so that NORAD headquarters could display the information on the board that actually was a real-time display of this, with that 7-second delay in there, of the air situation as it was being seen by the north, by the regional commander out in the boondock, so to speak. So the exercises would normally involve the two aspects of both space or missiles and a bomber attack. There were occasions when the exercises were restricted purely and simply to a missile attack. And all kinds of combinations and computations of missile attacks were worked up by these exercise people purely and simply to really test the primary function of NORAD, or the commander of NORAD, which is to advise the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of Canada that there is an attack about to take place on North America, and
what kind of an attack it is. And these rascals would write scenarios where there would be, all of a sudden, one damn missile would come roaring in, and with that, the red phone would be rattling so sorry. We have a madman who pooped off that one missile. Sorry about it, but in the meantime, of course, there had been great political tension going on in the scenario, and so you didn't know whether it was the beginning of a blackmail or whether it really was some nut.
Oh,
should you respond in kind? Should you recommend to the president that this was a deliberate act of war and should be retaliated, or was it really someone who had got a little quick on the trigger? And from that, right up through, say, half a dozen to a dozen missiles being launched as a real threat, saying these are coming, and if you do not either compromise or give in, we will then be, we'll follow this up with a lot more. And what do you do then? Do you retaliate, or do you leave it to the politicians to try and figure out whether they should sit tight? And you can get into an enormous number of very difficult situations, I can assure you, as to because it is NORAD's responsibility to advise the president, this is what has happened, here is what we know in the way of alerts and so forth, and here's what we think is going to happen. Now that's where it gets to be a bit thin, a bit tricky, because you are the only one, insofar as the strategic side is concerned, that is the missile side, the very big thing, you are the only one advising the president. Now, he's got information coming in from Europe. The United States Air Force, the United States forces would have their intelligence organizations feeding stuff into Washington. But NORAD is the only outfit that has the detecting devices all being fed into the one center for interpretation. And that, it just proves again that old business that no matter how computerized you might be, how many detection systems you might have, in the final analysis it still comes down to one man who's saying, here's what's happened and here's what I think is going to happen. And on that, then the Joint Chiefs and the President have to make some pretty hairy decisions.
But nevertheless, you are a... Again, sticking straight to the missile. And leaving aside strategic air command and your fighter interceptors, all you can do really is advise. You're purely intelligence.
Oh yes.
Insofar as missiles are concerned, you can't at that stage hit another missile.
No. Although while I was there, the anti-ballistic missile system was being built.
Yeah.
One, the big one, was being built. It was codenamed Safeguard. They were building the radars. It was up in North Dakota, right in sort of in the middle of the Minuteman, of Strategic Air Command's Minuteman missile fields. And that was an incredible installation. Aside from all the detection equipment, that is the radars, they also, of course, had two missiles. One that was a short-range missile and one was a long-range missile. Those intercepting missiles to intercept incoming ICBMs. Mm-hmm. And just incredible, the technology that was involved in that whole system was unbelievable. SDC were involved with doing a lot of the software, System Development Corporation in Santa Monica, were doing a lot of the software for this. And the computations required to bring about two missiles meeting head on, basically in space, was such that they required, with the computer knowledge that was available then, they needed four computers working, doing all the, doing various parts of the equation.
and then one master computer, which would take the output from each of the computers working on its part of the equation, and then putting the whole equation together to be the to actually give the direction to the missiles. I had an opportunity, and I'm glad I did, to go and visit the safeguard site, because it's now canceled, of course. Yeah. The Americans killed that whole program. And the only thing that they've kept going is one of the big, the radars they've kept going, because they're still very valuable for detecting any incoming missiles. So those are fabulous radars, phased array radars. It's just unbelievable. With the enormous investment that there was in all the technology and actually construction of these sites, they haven't just closed it and walked away. They've kept the radars for and as a part of NORAD, and thank God they have, because it's, again, a state of technology, and it's way, way downstream.
But am I not right in thinking that the Russians have kept their ABM around Moscow?
Yes, they have, or at least we understand they have.
Yeah.
They put an ABM system in around Moscow. And that is the reason why, when they discussed the business of anti-ballistic missile defense, it was decided that each country should be allowed to build two. The reason was that Moscow, there was one already in existence around Moscow. The Americans had already started one out in their missile field. So it was agreed that the Americans could put one around Washington and the Russians could put one out around their missile field. And that was how the two figures were arrived at. But it became so costly that, and with the advancement in missile ICBM technology, where you got down to murdering and the independently targeting that could go on with all these warheads being scattered, you have dummies. Obviously, in a military sense, the balance went over to the ICBM side, or the offensive side, rather than the defensive side. To cope with the development that was taking place in ICBMs would have meant building installations of the safeguard size all over the United States with hundreds and hundreds of missiles, and of course the financial aspect of that just went right off the clock. Even the USA couldn't cope with those kind of expenditures. After having built one and proven it and just copying the setup, it became too costly. And that was why the Americans finally dropped the whole thing, and SALT came along as well.
Yeah. But at the time, again, when you were there, you mentioned visiting it, but was it in operation at that time?
It was in its initial operational stage.
Ah, I see.
During the test.